Next case is 96-1509, Donald Didier versus Eric Johns. Mr. Brandon. Is Mr. Brandon here? You, Mr. Brandon? Your case has been called.
Please, this honorable court, the facts of this case makes it very easy to decide that the trial court and the Court of Appeals is error. However, in this case, there's much more significant issues for the trial court bar and the administration of justice in the civil negligence area. First of all, the facts of this case indicate that the plaintiff, appellant in this case, was riding his motorcycle behind a school bus. At the same time, Mr. Johns, defendant, fell asleep, driving his car in the opposite direction, crossed the center line, and struck the school bus. Even the trial court found in its decision that the John's car could have caused, or may have caused, the bus to stop short, and Mr. Didier struck the rear end of the school bus, causing three injuries to himself, including brain damage.
If a deer had run across in front of the school bus and the school bus had stopped, just as it did here, but what about a sure clear distance?
You would have had no negligence with their partner.
Well, but I thought the rule for a sure clear distance was designed so that when I'm driving my car, I stay far enough behind the car in front of me that I can stop, regardless of whatever the cause of that automobile's reason to stop is.
Mr. Chief Justice, that's true. However, the rule has been very well written or very well modified through the years by this court to say that if a sure clear distance is cut down by negligence of another, or in some other fashion, that in fact the sure clear distance is a negligence per se. But assuming even that negligence per se was an issue here, what has happened here, this is a backdoor way to go back to contributory negligence. It's a means to use negligence per se against negligence per se. Assuming Mr. Didier in this case was negligent per se. We certainly know that someone coming across the center line is negligent per se. Therefore, certainly, comparative principles would apply by the legislature's dictate. What has been done here is the defense bar has argued it becomes contrived. As soon as you show negligence per se on the part of the plaintiff, then his case is gone. And as you well know, negligence per se and negligence itself is really not very much of a distinction, except there's a statutory duty finding the duty in negligence per se, where in negligence alone, it's a duty. Often there are differences without a distinction, as this word is found. So what in fact has happened here is, unlike with the deer, as you say, we have a situation where another person has put in motion a chain of events that has caused, one, either my client to be negligent per se, in which case he still is entitled to a fact-finding by the jury, or two, he is not even negligent per se, and the jury can find that he was exercising due care under the Cincinnati Traction case, and find that in fact his negligence may have not even contributed to it, and therefore the defendant, the driver of the vehicle across the center line, was 100% negligent. So the issue here is very, and the other states have shown, this is just a way to bring contributory negligence back into the arena of the trial court. Very confusing. It's a very clever argument, but what it does is it takes away the basic fundamental principle of law that's been well established by the legislature, and it's very well described by this court, and twists it.
Was the bus hit by the car while it was still moving?
The bus was struck.
No, that's not my question.
I'm sorry.
Was the bus still moving when the car struck it and glanced off and went into the ditch. But had it completely stopped, was it still rolling, had it applied the brakes? What are the facts?
Yes, it was still.
Pardon?
The car was struck the bus, yes, it was still moving in our opinion.
It was still moving.
According to our factual evidence, the way we interpreted that, that's a factual issue for the court. There was different opinions on it.
Was the bus braking at the time it was hit?
I believe it was. The evidence would show that. There
so
again, it's a factual issue.
The bus had not stopped and then was hit by the car.
That's again a factual issue. It certainly was braking and slowing down.
Don't you remember the facts?
I can't remember. That was disputed. Our position is it was stopped cold by the striking of the bus, by the striking of the car. That was disputed. Our version of the facts, and we would have presented had we had the opportunity, and the court did not find any differently, was, and the court's factual finding was, that but for the fact that the car was, that rather the striking of the bus did cause a lessening of the distance. I don't believe it. The court's finding is exactly that. There could have been different issues.
So that's a dispute.
Pardon me?
That's a dispute.
That's why it should have went to a jury. Exactly.
The fact in dispute is whether the bus was still moving at the time it was hit by the car.
That's one of the facts in dispute. Although the court found, as I said, that the striking of the bus by Mr. John's car could have or did cause a lessening of the distance. But she said it didn't matter because the following car, the following Mr. Didier on his motorcycle, was negligence per se.
So the trial court's theory was whether the car came across and hit the bus head on. Under any factor, your client was negligent because he hit the rear of the bus.
Precisely. And her finding very clearly, and to be stated in our brief clearly, she said, it doesn't matter. She found that, in fact, it may have very well caused a lessening of the shear clear distance.
So had the bus not been able to put on the brakes at all, just got hit head-on without any notice, still the reason that your client hit the rear of the bus precluded him from any recovery.
Absolutely not. That is applying a.
Was that what the trial court said?
The trial court said that.
That's what I mean. That's what the trial court said.
That's the problem. They have indirectly done what they said. Indirectly have gone back to a contributory here. Let's assume two people are negligent per se. Certainly, that finding alone would allow the submission of this issue to a jury to determine the relative fault. The comparative fault, not finding the trial court. The second issue that comes up in the case again.
You don't compare fault to your counsel where there's the sole proximate cause of the plaintiff's injuries. The sole cause is his own conduct.
I agree it was the sole cause. But
isn't that the finding of the trial court and at least the decision of the Court of Appeals is that the sole proximate cause. Negligence per se does not determine proximate cause, only duty and breach.
Right.
And then the trial or the Court of Appeals opinion says the sole proximate cause of the plaintiff's injuries was his failure to follow the shared clear distance. And I guess the biggest factual issue is that the bus did not stop abruptly. The deer running in front, you know, all this is a sudden change in the progression of a line of vehicles. So where there's a sudden change, that may really help a plaintiff's cause. But here, if that isn't the situation, the court found sole proximate cause. So we're really not talking about contrib, are we?
Well, yes, you are. See, that's the problem. And I think that's where the confusion comes in. You're correct. The trial court and the Court of Appeals confuse the issue of duty with the issue of causation in regards to those issues. We'll discuss that in a moment. But
I don't think I said they confused it.
Well, I believe they confused it. But in this case, they found, as a matter of law, not fact, that the original negligence of John's car coming across the center line was such that that Mr. Didier could have foreseen it, that it wasn't new, it didn't initiate the negligence, it was caused an independent superseding act on the part of Mr. Didier on his motorcycle, and that's not the case. This is a case where an application of a fact would show that it certainly there's an issue in the circumstances as to whether or not there's a factual issue And this court has numerous cases that indicate that.
Counsel, in your own brief, you say, due to Johnson's car traveling onto the oncoming eastbound lane, the school bus was forced to stop suddenly. And the brief of the other side says, we adopt your statement of fact, except we don't agree that you were forced into the bus. If they have a bus that maybe somebody stops the lane from him or comes across the lane, then the bus certainly has a great deal more momentum and needs longer to stop. I think that's common sense physics. Then a motorcycle comes to a stop. They've obviously taken care of their problem, and your guy behind them, I'm not following the chain why your guy shouldn't be able to stop if a bus can stop when this guy comes across the lane.
Well, simply stated, then you just ignore the fact that the person who crossed the center line caused the entire accident, caused a series of events that my client couldn't have foreseen. How could Mr. Didier foresee?
I could buy that if the bus didn't stop itself. But when you yourself conceived the bus stopped completely in time, and then the guy hits them, to me that does break the chain of causation, because you've not got a situation where the bus is continuing to roll into the car.
Well, I respectfully would say that the other states that have addressed this issue is not so bound, and in the case law indicated here, whether that's a fact or not, let's assume that he could or should, he didn't have any type of the situation itself was created by the negligence of another. What we're doing here is saying that doesn't matter. You can go across the center line, cause an accident like this, but for him going across the center line, there would have been no collision with the rear. He certainly had an opportunity to have adjusted before or after, to have not collided with the rear of the bus. Maybe there was a particularly clear indication to him that this bus wasn't going to stop.
So then your argument would be any time a car in front of you stops suddenly in traffic for whatever reason, you have an ability to compare their reasons for stopping versus your reasons for failing to maintain ACDA.
In the last 100 cases like that I presented to trial courts, they made me do that. They found that there's a comparative issue. I never get an exchange per se, direct verdict or a verdict, a summary judgment or a direct verdict on negligence anymore. I always get comparative. So that's been done to me in the trial court. The decisions of this court have caused it to happen. There's always an issue of discernibility, the issues of a fact, at least it's been told to me, but in this case, in using it against me, and the plaintiff's bar, as we see it, they're making it into a non-issue of fact, but an issue of law. So I can state to this court, this happens every day in the opposite direction, and very often.
Well, I guess the problem I'm having is that the General Assembly, I would guess, must have heard at least some of these arguments when it adopted 4511.21a, and as you know, it says, no person shall operate a motor vehicle upon any street or highway, and so forth, at a greater speed that will permit him to bring it to a stop within the assured clear distance ahead. Now, I assume that's the distance between the subject vehicle, the motorcycle here, and the bus. That it says nothing about who causes the vehicle ahead to stop, who or what causes it to stop. It means that if I'm driving behind a school bus, I have to leave enough distance that if a person walks in front of the school bus and causes it to slam on its brakes, or a car comes across the center line, I have to be able to stop. And in Ziegler, wouldn't we have to change the rule in Ziegler to do what you want us to do?
You very well.
And you would like us to do.
Interpret it, perhaps. But yeah. The point is that when you're talking and putting it that way, first of all, it's not the facts of this case. The facts of this case makes it clear that there was a factual issue. But second, in that regards, I can tell you that in every trial I have a rear-end case where I'm the plaintiff, I'm being told that we have to show that it was clearly discernible, that there was no emergency condition. No, sir. And
yeah.
I believe that even if you considered that, it would still be an issue that would should be submitted to a jury in this particular case and in most. And I think your case law, again, we ignore that it's not foreseeable that someone's going to cross the center line in front of the vehicle in front of us. Period.
But Ziegler doesn't provide for that. The statute doesn't provide for that, and neither does Ziegler. Ziegler was ahead of him in his path of travel. The school bus was. was stationary or moving in the same direction as the driver, which it was, did not suddenly appear in the driver's path. The school bus didn't appear in the driver. That's this. Remember, this is assured clear distance of the vehicle ahead of my vehicle, not the car that comes across the center line, and that was reasonably discernible.
Every day people follow too closely and don't have an accident. People following too closely shouldn't, but they are adjusting as the way they drive. They look.
Sure.
If someone comes across the center line and causes the accident, I don't think that's any exculpation for the person that comes across the center line. What we're doing here is basically saying that while a sure clear distance is a more negligent per se than would be a crossing the center line, I think we can much more readily adapt to the ACA, to the assured clear distance, that we can to someone coming across the center line and causing an accident. These things happen quickly, fast, and so forth, and I'm saying that this is clearly an issue of fact, and that we have, what has happened here is actually a contributory standard that applies to negligence per se. Now, I understand what the intervening supersede, but the cases of the site clearly show that where there's a beginning in a negligent act.
And again, it looks like the time expired here, but it looks like we're having reserved here. So, yeah, you have a little time.
The issue is just as important in this case as being practical and not something ethereal, Alice in Wonderland, and so on. And Judge Jones is a good friend of mine, a great professional, good judge, but when he went off on this, he did a very great harm to the trial bar in the simplicity that we actually restate on the rules of causation. They're not nearly that difficult.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Brandon. Mr. McLandridge.
May it please the court. My name is John McLandridge. I represent Eric Johnson in this case. First off, Your Honor, I'd like to state there's no question of fact in this case. Mr. Didier's been clear. He has no recollection of the events leading to this accident other than the fact he's driving along the road behind the school bus. In terms of the events of the accident, he has no recollection at all. In terms of the question that was posed to the bench earlier, about the school bus stopping or not stopping, the trial court, in its opinion, doesn't say that the school bus was stopped by the impact of Mr. Johns. The school bus stopped under its own power. I think that's clear from the record. Mr. Didier, further...
Well, that would seem to be the question, as to whether or not there's a factual dispute
about how the bus stops.
As to whether or not the bus stopped, saw the car coming over, stopped in the roadway, or whether or not being tapped had something to do with the bus losing momentum.
Those are two
different factors. I mean, if would you not agree that if your client's got to drive a semi, comes across, cracks the bus, causing it to suddenly stop. The guy behind now gets the jury, doesn't he?
Well, it real candidly, it's like this, the way I see it. It depends on how you want to define assured clear distance. You know, we all took driving school. Well, the assured clear distance was the distance between you and the car ahead of you, the speed you're traveling, you can stop before you reach where he is now. All right. Now, the reality is a lot of people don't drive that way, but that means if you take a sure question is literally, that's what it means. Now, if you take it less than literally, what it means is I've left enough distance between myself and the car ahead of me that if my reaction time is good enough, when he stops, the difference in space between us and the difference in braking rates between my vehicle and his is such that I'll be able to stop before I reach the point where he is now.
Well, I thought there was a well-developed body of law, rules law. Seems like it's a good one that the assured clear distance is an insurmountable problem unless someone comes into the lane traveling and reduces
it.
And that's a good rule, isn't it?
It's a good rule, and this is in the sudden emergency cases. No one comes in to Mr. Didier's assured clear distance and reduces it to cut it down. Now, the proposition that we're debating now here today, though, is if the vehicle which is struck is caused to stop in an unnaturally quick manner, in other words, let's say I'm going across the road and I'm hauling a forge on my semi, for example, and now my school bus hits that forge and comes to an instantaneous stop. Mr. Didier's following behind it, slams into the school bus. question the court's going to have to decide is Mr. Digger required to leave enough space in the learning driving school such that I see the school bus 100 yards to stop ahead of me, I need 100 yards to stop at 35 miles an hour, I'll be able to stop even if he stops instantaneously, or does he get the cushion of, you know, I'm 100 yards behind, school bus stops so fast, I stop so fast.
What do you think the answer to that ought to be?
Well, frankly, I think the answer ought to be that required to do what the statute says, which is leave the sure clear distance, so that when, even if the school bus stops instantaneously, I have enough room to stop between where I am and where he is.
Wouldn't that run contrary to the common experience, not just the common experience, but also the professional accident reconstruction expert who tells you there's a half second to the brain to command the foot to hit the brakes? I mean, everybody reasonably factors that in when they're driving. Nobody can stop instantaneously,
right?
Unless somebody else negligently, one would assume, because if that guy stops instantaneously, he's had an accident caused by somebody else.
I agree with that. And as a practical matter, people don't drive that way. But the other flip side of that is, as a practical matter, I also don't need that rule to win this case, because that's not what happened here. But in terms of the standard, you're absolutely right, because, you know, the reality is, if you're driving on the freeway or on a road, can you actually leave what would be the sure clear distance? Somebody fills that in immediately. You know, I mean, if you're left the 10 car lengths, whatever it is, on the freeway, that you need to be able to stop if that vehicle ahead of you instantaneously stops, you're never going to be able to maintain it, because somebody's going to be continually cutting you off. I mean, this is the reality of life. But, you know, now that we're back at the statute, it seems to me, though.
Shouldn't we make this statute fit the realities of life?
I think it does need to fit the reality of life to a degree. But, you know, unfortunately, the legislature has the prerogative to set the standard what it is. And there's a lot of laws that frankly don't exactly mirror the realities of life. And what we have in this case is a situation where the legislature has allocated the burden between the car that's trailing and the car that's ahead. And what it's done is it's placed the burden on the car that's trailing. And it said, it's your responsibility to leave enough distance between you and the car ahead of you.
But it left to the courts to fill in what the true meaning of a sure clear distance is.
I think that's true. I mean, like every law, you know, that's to be set forth. But I think, given the language of sure clear distance, that room that the court has to interpret is more limited than if they said, like counsel wants to say, you know, other states have held otherwise. Other states
One final question, I'll be done.
That is,
you maintain that there was no factual dispute as to whether or not your client abruptly impeded the forward momentum of the bus. In other words, all of the forward momentum of the bus, all of the stopping on the part of the bus occurred as a result of the braking of the bus driver, and none of it occurred as a result of the crash with your client.
What I can tell you is this. I can tell you Mr. Digger has no recollection of the accident. I can tell you the bus didn't file a claim for any damage to the bus. I can tell you that the way it's been described in the record is that they nicked bumpers. Now, you know, from that, can I say absolutely 0000 of the momentum got transferred to the car? I don't know that I can say it's 0000. All I can tell you is that the way it's been characterized in the record, what I've seen in depositions and all the records in the case, is the bus comes to stop, they dig bumpers, Mr. Digger continues across the roadway, or I'm sorry, Mr. Johns continues across the roadway, ends up in a ditch, then Mr. Digger slams into the back of the school bus. No. Plaintiff's counsel at times seems to be on different courses in terms of whether Mr. Digger was in fact in violation of the sure clear distance statute. Just to lay that to rest, I mean, I think the law of the trial court applied, the court of appeals applied, all the facts extremely clear. Speaks to the yellow school bus, right behind it, school bus stops, stay light, dry, clear, all the rest of it, he slams in the back.
I thought he conceded that.
No, this morning, he conceded the reply brief. He didn't concede the brief on appeal. He conceded the reply brief. Then an argument today, he's saying, well, you know, maybe he wasn't a sure clear distance violation. The jury could have found that it wasn't his fault, that he was acting reasonably, and that Mr. Johns was 100% at fault. So to the extent that he backs lying off of that, I just want to make sure that I get up here and say, he's ACD, he paid his ticket, he's ACD, and I don't have any question about it. Stacy. The only question is whether Mr. John's negligence continued through the whole course of events to help produce Mr. Dieter's injuries, or Mr. Dieter's injuries were produced as a result of his own negligent conduct.
Counsel, are you saying you see no difference whatsoever, and these facts are identical, whether or not a car hit the bus suddenly, hit it head-on, and the bus never had a chance to put its brakes on, and a bus stops and a car comes along and nicks it and goes away?
No.
They're the same thing?
No, they're very different cases.
Well,
isn't
that a question of facts, what we have here? I keep on hearing that there's no question of fact, and then you said, well, in your recitation of the facts, the bus came to a halt, stopped, and then was nicked by the car. What, is that what happened? It was nicked by the car?
It was nicked by the car.
Then the car didn't cause the bus to suddenly stop?
Well,
the car stopped at the night naturally and stopped and waited for the car to hit it? Is that what had happened?
As I understand it, the bus brakes hard, the bus comes to a stop, and Mr. Dieter nicks it.
That's it?
That's
it. They agree with you that those are the facts?
As I understand it, yes, sir.
As you understand it, what does that mean?
Mr. Johns.
Based on all the information that I have, and based on what I've seen in the record.
And that was a finding by the trial court?
Right.
And the Court of Appeals?
Right.
You said Mr. Dieter, you meant Mr. Johns nicks it, right?
That's right, Mr. Johns nicks it.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Right.
Well, the trial judge, do we care what she says? The bus in front of plaintiff was forced to stop quickly. And as a result, plaintiff was required to stop quickly. However, plaintiff was unable to stop quickly enough, and so forth. The trial court apparently, summary judgment, but finds that the bus was forced to stop quickly.
There's any question the bus was forced to stop quickly. And I think, frankly, you know, this goes back to the purpose of the shared clear distance statute, which is completely foreseeable in driving the car. It says there are going to be unexpected events with cars, the car in front of you, have to stop quickly.
Yeah, I guess I wonder why you haven't a chance to argue that, but it seems to me that, again, we've only said that if the bus would all of a sudden appear to the person in the motorcycle, then obviously there's an exception for a sure clear distance.
Right.
There's no exception made for why the bus is forced to stop, is there? I mean, the statute doesn't say, and we haven't said that if the vehicle ahead of you is forced to stop for some reason, that's where the per se liability is. It doesn't matter what the reason is. The statute says you have to leave enough room, you have to assume the bus is going to stop quickly. I guess that's what the statute says,
exactly.
Essentially.
And, you know, we're talking about importing the statute to reality of driving. This is the reality of driving, is that vehicles ahead of you, on occasion, are going to have to make a quick stop, whether it's for a ball rolling into the road, the deer running across the road, person we now see is the address they've been looking for, you know, they drop the hot cigarette in their lap, whatever it is. And the legislature in that circumstance has placed the burden on the trailing car to make sure that the distance is sufficient to allow for a stop. And it's because they bear the burden of assuring that the distance is adequate that the negligence of Mr. Johns isn't the proximate cause of Mr. Dieter's injuries. And, you know, as much as I thought about the case, I think that's what it comes down to. I think it's very straightforward and fairly simple and common sense. And I think it should be the law of the land. With that, we'd ask you to...
Or at least Ohio.
Certainly, just... Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McLandich. Mr. Bannon, you've used your time. It would take 30 seconds, if you like.
Yes. Your Honor, the fact the decision of the trial court was and adopted by the appellate court was the fact that John's car caused the bus in front of Dieter's motorcycle to stop short does not bear on the fact. One of the events a bit different. I mean, the trial court, I believe, very clearly found it didn't matter. And it does matter. It becomes a factual issue. Obviously, if you want to get into a sure clear distance as per se, or as perhaps being exculpated by these factors. But nevertheless, the case law of this court that talks about what in fact becomes a superseding, intervening, independent cause doesn't apply to this case. It is not cut off the proximate cause. This wrong side of the street, falling asleep person who didn't nick a bus, remember when it crossed it, they talk about nicking it. The big heavy bumpers they put on it didn't look at the car, didn't talk about the damage to the car. And yes, my client nicked the rear of the bus, but his head, his motorcyclist,
as I understand, still have wall from the highway to the pile. And in fact, it didn't take much of a collision. But just that very little difference was ignored by the trial court. Any expert opinion or anything else was not to be permitted. It was just directed at the county. And quite frankly, that's not the law of the time. It's not fair.
Because your words barely nick. That's your language. Your dreams.
Well, maybe we can talk about how he struck. He went across the bus, all the way across the bus, straight across the bus, and damaged himself, so I understand. Maybe he should have chosen a better word. Maybe he should have said crash. Those are terms that our sports uses indiscriminately sometimes. I try not to make it look too bad, because I think it was negligence per se here that the rule would allow comparison. Why does negligence compare any different than negligence compare? There is not a proximate cause issue here that takes this case to the jury.
Thank you, Mr. Brandon. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
All right.